Behind the Badge Illinois, giving you the inside scoop on public safety and those who protect and serve. Your real stories directly from law enforcement experts and get a chance to ask questions about issues you've always wanted to know more about. You have the right to remain informed. This is Behind the Badge Illinois.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Badge Illinois. I'm David Hochberg, your host. Let's get the commercial aspect of this out of the way. If you're looking to refinance or your existing home or purchase your new home, give me a call because I am the proud sponsor of this podcast at Team Hochberg. We love working with first responders, veterans, anybody looking to purchase a new home or refinance your existing home, 855-563-2843 or go to 56david.com. We are going to be talking about on today's podcast, use of force and de-escalation. I'm going to go around the horn, then throw it over to Chief Jogman to dive a little deeper into those topics. But I first want to welcome, with us today is retired Colonel of Patrol, Mimi McGrill. Welcome back, Mimi. We've got Chief up in DeKalb, Chief Bird, David Bird of the DeKalb Police Department, Chief Jogman up in Highland Park. Like to welcome Chief Lally from the great town of Elgin to the podcast Behind the Badge Illinois, which, by the way, is now up and running on WGN Radio. You could go to WGN Radio podcast, type in Behind the Badge, and we'll come up if you're going there. And it's on YouTube. Type in Behind the Badge Illinois, thanks to AJ and her hard efforts down there in Springfield to get it up on YouTube. So Chief Lally, welcome.
Thank you.
We want to thank you in advance for your expertise and your knowledge, and briefly introduce yourself, my friend.
So hello, everyone. First, I'd like to just say thank you to you guys for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate the opportunity to just anytime get a chance to talk about the law enforcement profession and obviously, you know, things here in Elgin. So my name is Anna Lally. I have been in Elgin. I will start my 29th year, I think, in about almost 3 or 4 days. So wow. I've been here my whole entire career. I love it. I love the police department. I love the people in the department. I love the Elgin community. I've been the police chief here for, it'll be 6 years in July. So I was a sergeant, obviously a police officer. I was a detective in our narcotics unit. I've been a sergeant, a lieutenant, a commander. And then in 2018, I became the police chief. So Elgin is the sixth largest city in the state of Illinois. Well, our population is about 114,000, give or take. We have a huge Hispanic population, Latina population. Our philosophy of the police department is community engagement. It's making the community the best it can be and making the police department it the best it can be. So happy to be here. And again, thank you. And welcome to all the listeners, too, as well.
And just to give a little deeper before I throw it over to Lou, you've got a diverse population. Like you've got homes from 100,000 up to $2.8 million. So, you know, from a mortgage standpoint, it's all over the board. So,
yes.
Very interesting. I didn't realize it was the sixth largest town in the great state of Illinois. And congratulations on your tenure there. That's outstanding. So
thank you.
We're going to bring it on now, Lou. The use of force and de-escalation. We were talking about throwing around topics for today, and I took a citizens board at my local, the Citizen Police Academy. I think whatever you guys call that, about 4 or 5 months ago. And here in my town in Northbrook, 33,000 people, Chief, so not as big as 103 in Elgin, but we're small compared to Elgin. But I found it fascinating in the 9-10 weeks that I went to this course, the course about de-escalation and the training that goes in as a citizen. I had no idea of the special training. You get a special recognition, and they have special sergeant, I think, in charge of de-escalation here in Northbrook, which completely blew my mind, which is great. I had no idea. So can you dive a little deeper, Chief Jogman, before we expand the conversation, what use of force and de-escalation is all about for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the most important things, I think, for law enforcement and for our communities to understand and to try to be aligned on, because unfortunately, in our business and in our world, there are times when we're enforcing the law that we need to use some type of physical force to take a person into custody if they're not complying or if they're resisting. And it's horrible. It's horrible for the police officer. You know, no police officer really wants to get involved in physical altercation, injure somebody or be injured themselves or worse. We call it lawful but awful. I mean, it's legal. We have the right to take this person into custody, you know, essentially because there's probable cause for their arrest. People don't have the right to resist. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I do think this particular topic really is where the public and law enforcement sometimes collide, because there are often, even if it's a successful, and I call it successful arrest, where somebody's taken into custody, there are no injuries, it still looks horrible. It's still very stressful for everybody involved. And of course, it has the potential to end very negatively. So, you know, with the prominence of video cameras, you know, people are able to see what we've always been involved in our careers for the last 30 years. People are being able to see that now. And again, from an outside perspective, it looks terrible. It's violent. It's not what we want. But I think a great context for this use of force discussion that we're all going to have, and we're all working through this and dealing with this at every police agency and trying to make it the best we can. But it's kind of goes back to our 10 shared principles again. So our 10 shared principles, we talk about them often. It was a collaboration between the NAACP and the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, started around 2015 after the incident in St. Louis, where a young man was killed by the police and the resulting turmoil that came out of that. And so we worked together to try to figure out a best path forward for law enforcement and specifically communities of color, and came up with 10 shared principles of law enforcement. And specifically, today we're going to be talking about number 10. And number 10 is, we believe de-escalation training should be required to ensure the safety of community members and officers. We endorse using de-escalation tactics to reduce the potential for confrontations that endanger law enforcement officers and community members, and the principle that human life should be taken only as the last resort. So that is built into our 10. That makes the 10 because it's such an important issue. But we wouldn't have 10 if we didn't have 8. So number 8 is always an important one for us to talk about as well. And number 8 is really where the ownership comes on to the public to kind of understand, and that's what we're doing here today. Number 8 says, we believe that law enforcement and community leaders have a mutual responsibility to encourage all citizens to gain a better understanding and knowledge of the law to assist them in their interactions with law enforcement officers. So there's certainly the onus is on law enforcement, but there is definitely some responsibility on our public. And I think what's important about that one, and I think what we're seeing a lot of, and my colleagues can either agree or disagree or share their experience, but we seem to see a lot more resisting going on. And I'm not sure why that is, but what folks need to know is resisting a police officer is a crime. I know people don't want to be held to account often for what they've done, and so they want to get away. There's also a mental health component. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, we've got people that we're dealing with that are having a crisis. Unfortunately, our officers aren't in a position to know that at the time. They're reacting to the actions of the people that they're dealing with. And again, if they've got probable cause to take that person into custody, the citizen that's being taken into custody has the obligation to allow that to happen. But we don't see that, unfortunately, a lot. And those people drive the narrative and drive the actions, and we have to respond to that. And so it is a challenge for us. We always tell everybody, you're going to get your day in court. You know, I mean, clearly, police officers arrest people or take people into custody that aren't guilty. Maybe the witness got it wrong. Maybe the witness was malicious and we find out. But at the end of the day, that arrest piece, when we have the probable cause, you know, our residents they're supposed to comply. And so it puts us in a really bad spot. And so we've really worked on this de-escalation training, which I know all of us have. We'll be going around to talk about it, to try to bring the temperature down on these calls, whether it's a mental health call or a response to a criminal call. Again, though, you know, we can do what we can do, but we're kind of reacting to whatever the person we're dealing with is kind of driving the narrative there. So we'll do what we can. And I think we've come a long way. And the one thing I'll just touch on quickly before we turn it to the other panelists, as I said, a lot of our use of force incidents kind of arise out of mental health calls. I mean, it's, you know, obviously the people we're dealing with are in crisis. The officers, again, don't necessarily know. And at the end of the day, in crisis or not, if they're using violence towards the officers have to protect themselves. We want our officers to be safe. We see, unfortunately, all too often, a resisting arrest that turns into a fatal shooting of a police officer. I mean, it starts with the resisting, but then it ends in the death of a police officer. So the officers don't know what's going on in the mind of the person they're dealing with. So one of the things we've done, I think, a really good job of is trying to understand whether or not it's a mental health response or a criminal response. So our officers are receiving training, and I'm going to show you this. We're very low tech. We got to get a little better on this, but this is what it is. So this is a CIT. It's a crisis intervention team. It's a specific training course that's designed by NAMI and law enforcement practitioners to give law enforcement officers a better insight into what they might be dealing with when it comes to dealing with somebody that's undergoing a crisis. And I went through it. I have to say it's one of the best classes I've taken. It was 32 hours when I went, 4 days. And you're not certified as a psychologist when you walk out of there, but you certainly get a little bit of a thumbnail view of the different kinds of behaviors and things that people are undergoing. And I think the most impactful thing for me and what I hear from officers is they bring in consumers, folks that have undergone or are currently undergoing mental health issues. And when you hear from them, it's heartbreaking. You know, they will tell you, so we do role playing with them and they're part of it, which is really helpful. And they'll tell you, I don't want to be this way. I don't want to be the person that's calling you and I sound like a jerk and I'm bothering you or I'm not in control of my behaviors. And so our officers, I think, have gotten much, much better here in Highland Park. We've made it a mission to train every single officer with this. Not every department can do that, depending. It's time consuming. It's important. But it's something we've striven towards because we want to make sure that we're able to de-escalate, especially mental health calls. And I've seen it in our reporting over the years, the trends that have gone down, because it gives officers a skill set to work with people and the patients to understand that they're not doing this to be malicious or problematic. And it's just really, I think it's been a wonderful program. So for people that are out there, And people have come up to me too. If you see this on an officer, it's a pin that they generally will wear right, you know, above here, above your name tag. That means they've successfully completed it. They have the training. They understand. And the notion behind that is for consumers, for people that are out there, if they see that, they can know that that police officer has received that specialized training in mental health and that they have a better understanding. And I've had people come up to me even on the street and have recognized that pin and at city council meetings. And people know what that is, especially if, like I said, they're a consumer. So it's really, truly helped, I think, law enforcement be able to de-escalate those really tense situations when they're dealing with somebody that's in crisis. So just wanted to start there.
All right. So I'm going to start with, we're going to wade you in the water slowly here, Chief Lally. So I'll start with Mimi and you'll get the hang of it quickly here. So Chief, retired Colonel Mimi McGrill, when you were with the ISP, Illinois State Police, for all of those that, you know, I'm an expert now, ISP, after five of these podcasts, what type of training, you know, this is somewhat relatively new, right? It's been in the forefront now with all the mental health issues. Did they have this training when you were the Colonel of Patrol of the ISP? And how did you incorporate it with your officers?
At first, I thought you were going to go way back when I first got on the job, because I think that over the years, we've gotten so much better and we continually to try to make ourselves better, law enforcement across the board. But yes, so when I was the colonel, yes, we did have training on this. We incorporated it into our control and arrest tactics training for state police, which we do 4 times a year. And we would also send out bulletins and refresher courses online so that we're constantly discussing this topic, this very important topic, which is definitely needed. You know, and I always say that, you know, the more training that we can provide our officers in law enforcement, the better for everybody. So constantly reminding them, and then the role play. So in part of our training, we do role play, like Chief Jogman had said. So that's always good too, because you're placed in a situation where you have to now act and use those verbal skills for de-escalation. And, you know, something, you know, as the chief was talking, I was thinking that when the police are called, we are called to negative situations all the time. I don't think anyone on this call has ever gotten a call of, you know, report to so-and-so address for a birthday party to sing happy birthday to somebody. It's everything's negative. So you have to go there, you know, and de-escalate whatever type of situation you might be involved in. And, you know, a lot of that comes with starting to use your verbal skills. So, you know, I just wanted to point that out, that, you know, when the officers arrive, we know that it's some type of situation in a negative way that we're going to have to handle. And using those de-escalation techniques that we're trained in and that we keep up on our training with is definitely a way to go. And, you know, the goal at the end of the day is that everyone walks away safely. No one's injured. No one wants to get in those situations. So that's the goal at the end of each incident, that we can walk away. And, you know, yes, we have to take people into custody, but, you know, to avoid violence and a violent confrontation is truly what our goal is on those situations.
So Chief Lally, a couple of things stuck with me from the training I went through to the Citizens Police Academy. There were two videos and a situation that the officer in charge of the CIT brought up. So I'll bring one up to you. There was a gentleman who went missing. They found him on the side of a bridge overlooking a waterway, if you will, and just having problems. The police sent cars out there, blocked off the road, and a CIT officer was dispatched. And they had it all on video, which was fascinating to a guy like me that does, you know, real estate and mortgages, because I don't, you know, I'm the guy behind the police car going, what the hell's taking so long and why they got the road closed down, right? I don't know that there's a guy about ready, you know, thinking of killing himself that was, you know, was reported missing by his parents. It was a teenage kid, obviously going through some type of challenges, sitting there. Officer came in talking, got close enough to grab him and pull him back, right? But without that training, and I think it said elapsed time. Yeah, you know, they sped up the video. It was like an hour and 15 minutes or something like that. So, you know, for an hour and 15 minutes, this officer who was went through training, like, you know, like Lou mentioned and like Mimi just mentioned, what type of situations like that are you experiencing in Elgin with a population, a diverse population of over 100,000 people?
Yeah, so we here in Elgin, in about 4 or 5 years ago, we started to notice an increase in mental health calls. And just to give you guys some, you know, last year we responded, or we had over 1,300 mental health calls for service. So, wow. You know, and we started kind of seeing this increase. And so we decided, you know, again, to be responsive to the community, we decided to create something called our Collaborative Crisis Services Unit. And what that unit does, it's law enforcement officers who are paired with mental health professionals in a co-response model. So we have social workers in the police department, and we've had social workers for, I mean, ever since I've been here. Social workers, you know, they're more victim-geared, more victim-centric. But our mental health professionals working with police officers and really, you know, not only addressing the immediate concern for a person who is emotionally distressed, but then the wraparound services, because the goal is the first time that you have that encounter, you know, we were experiencing going to calls where this is the third or the fourth time that we're, you know, being called to a location and engaging with an individual. And so we, you know, realized we have to do a little bit more on the back end. So where people are not in crisis, and that's one of the tenets of crisis intervention training, which is, you know, effective communication skills and understanding that each encounter with a person, the law enforcement officer has to understand the magnitude that they might be engaged in some type of, you know, whether it's a response to resistance, which is what we call it here. Response to resistance is our use of force, but then also our show of force, and understanding the magnitude of the decisions that need to be made. So incorporating that unit, additionally, we started teaching a couple of years ago through the Police Executive Research Forum, something called ICAT, I-C-A-T. So that's Integrating Communications Assessments and Tactics. And basically, ICAT teaches officers critical thinking. So there's a critical decision-making model that's centered upon five core values of assessing the risk, taking a step back, slowing it down, considering, you know, what the police agency, what their powers are, and then identifying outcomes. You know, so, you know, you can go back, you can go forward, you can assess, you can act, you can review, collecting that information. It's a constant loop. So through our ICAT training, it teaches officers really, you know, the concept of stepping up and stepping in, that critical decision making, which I think a lot of times we get asked, you know, what's, you know, what do you, you know, when you hire people, and what's one number one thing that you want to see in a police officer? And I will tell you, you know, a lot of times when I answer that, it's a good head, a good heart. And then it's a little asterisk of something with critical thinking, because when officers are going to these calls for service that involve an emotionally distressed person, the critical thinking that needs to go on to respond accordingly within the proportions of what the ethics, the training, the values of the organization, but also the community, is something that, you know, we really focus on here. And in 2019, I want to say it was late 2018 or 2019, we actually sent officers. We kind of did a trip that PERF did, where they went to London and to Scotland and then to New York, and looked at how do these organizations, you know, how do they address violent encounters where people are not, you know, usually when they're armed with a knife or an edged weapon. And so we sent officers to London, we sent officers to Scotland, and then eventually came back here and went to New York and looked at their ESU unit, which is the unit that deals with mental health and people who are in crisis. And then we created something here on a smaller version called our Emergency Services Detail. And that is really the tactical component to responding to these calls. It allows, you know, teaching the concepts of reactionary time and, you know, using tactical crisis communication. So we pair our ESD with our, you know, CIT officers. All our officers here get trained in CIT. We actually have our dispatchers trained in CIT, our community services officers, because they too have to, you know, and may engage with the community and understanding some of those de-escalation techniques and communication skills. So we paired the tactical component of slowing things down, making the scene safe, with then that a communication component, whether that's through our crisis, you know, counselors or, you know, officers who are negotiators, and then try to slow that scene down, always coming back to the critical decision-making model. So it's, you know, when I was hired 28 years ago, it was very different. And I think probably all of us can attest to that. So, you know, we've really embraced the concept of ICAT and really incorporated into our training and our lessons. And I think the other most important thing, too, is every call is unique. Every situation is unique. And so the community going through the Citizens Police Academy and coming and see what we do, and then, you know, debriefing with the officers on incidents and, you know, using that as a learning tool and constantly wanting to know how can we do better, how can we be better. And that's not a bad thing, you know, especially if you have young officers that may make some, you know, they made a mistake that's probably, you know, it's not the end of the world. But when they look back at it, they say, you know what, I probably could have done something better. And so encouraging and fostering an environment where you can talk about these things and learning from things. And Lou had mentioned at the very beginning, the lawful but awful phrase, right? And when you see some of the incidents with use of force and being able to take a step back and say, you know, okay, in this situation, you know, if that were to happen here, what would we do and how would we do it better? So, you know, I think it's a lot. This topic is vast, you know, that these are some of the things here, especially when you asked, you know, how many people and calls for service do we go on? It's a lot. Additionally, you know, over the 52,000 calls for service that we had last year, 96 of them resulted in some type of response to resistance. And 60 of those 96 were a use of force. And the vast majority of the use of forces were some type of armed risk control. And we noticed that our use of force incidents, as after we incorporated ICAT and CCSU and some of these tactics, we've noticed that our use of force stats have continued to go on a decline. And so I think it's a lot about just embracing the philosophy of communication and instilling that, and then also having the community understand what you do, you know, and what, you know, in the Elgin community, people know what CCSU, they know what ESD is because, you know, we talk about it. You know, we make sure that the public sees what we do and that we're very transparent with our use of force stats. You can go on our transparency hub and see all our use of force stats. So I think it's always a work in progress. I think that, you know, every day is trying to do something to make it better for the community. And every day it's being responsive to the officers' needs too as well. But when you pair the community with your department and, you know, understanding and learning, you know, I think that's usually where, you know, where the magic happens and where, you know, hopefully you'll see some of these incidents continue to decrease.
All right. We're going to go northwest to
David. David, real quick.
Yes. Go ahead, Luke.
sir, a permission for a police acronym explanation.
You're going to do it anyway. So go ahead.
You know, I am. So you're going to be my test subject. Do you know what PERF is?
PERF. I didn't hear what. PERF.
Yeah.
I think I do, but I can't get it from my brain to my tongue.
If you do, I'll be thoroughly impressed. Go ahead.
No, it's somebody that you're trying to apprehend, right? A PERF.
No.
That, sir, that would be a PERP.
PERP. All right. Well, they got the PER.
All right. So
there, Chief. That's, you know, okay. What a negatively amortized loan is, Chief?
I'll admit that I don't. How about that? Touché. I'll admit that I don't. All right. But I don't watch TV shows about mortgage brokers, so you should at least know something. So, all right. So Chief Lally, we do this all the time. We talked about it, right? So what we try to do is just and share a little bit with our public that might not know what these acronyms are. We have tons of them. Yep. So PERF is the Police Executive Research Forum. Yes. And they are a group that helps the delivery of police services through the exercise of strong national leadership. So they review, they're like a research think tank. Yes. And so Chief Lally referred to them. So just putting that out there.
Yes.
All right.
Now I'm going to go northwest. Thanks for
now
that.
You can. Yeah. Cheers.
Appreciate that. So, so Chief Byrd, during the last episode of Behind the Badge, Illinois, you had mentioned that you have social workers on staff and you want to hire more. But I just want to give you an example of what happened here again during the police academy that I went to, the Citizen Police Academy that I went to. There was a situation here in Northbrook. Somebody was having mental challenges, barricaded themselves in their apartment, home, whatever. Police were sent out. One of the guys that was sent out, one of the officers was trained in CIT. They did a back, you know, check of the person that was barricaded, that barricaded themselves, and saw that this person had numerous firearms registered with the state of Illinois. So enhanced level of stress and difficulty for the officer. Long story short, the CIT officer de-escalated the situation from a suicide murder-suicide maybe type of situation where an officer could have gotten hurt and the individual barricading himself could have killed himself into a situation where the person before, one of the biggest concerns of the person after they took it down 400 levels was that he didn't want his guns taken away. And if he was and again, this was all news to me. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. That if he was arrested or whatever happened, because he was had registered firearms with the state, and I guess some of the guns were collector's guns that were very valuable, the officer, before this gentleman was arrested or whatever legal proceeding happened, went on the website that registers all the guns, had all the guns, transferred the guns, Chief Byrd, to a relative. Mm-hmm. So that the person who wanted to kill the police and kill himself now was more concerned about, hey, I want to get out of here. I need some help. I do need some help, but I don't want to get my guns. The officer helped them transfer the guns to a family member. And then the guy opened the door, was taken in. And to this day, okay, and this one fascinated me even more than that. I mean, that was like, oh, my God, I had no idea, right? Is that this individual that barricaded checks in with the CIT officer, if not on a monthly basis, on a weekly basis, just to say, hey, thanks. I'm doing my check-in. You know, he's getting the help that he needed, thank God. And he's checking in with the officer. And the officer of the officer said, if I don't get a call from this guy, I'll just drive over there and knock on the door to see how he's doing. And this is the stuff that you know, defund the police and cops suck. And, you know, I had some jerk on Twitter. Yeah, why are you raising money for the vest? The cops are taking the money, you know, from the drug dealers. This is what has to get out, right? That this CIT officer not only de-escalated it, saved the lives of the officers, saved the lives of the guy behind the barricade, transferred the guns to do a solid for the guy, and is checking in with the guy. I mean, that you don't think of that when you become, when I think of a police officer, that you're checking in with some mentally challenged resident here in Northbrook. And thank God he is. But that, you know, and you, and it spurred my thought when we were talking about topics for today, that you have social workers on staff. And can you talk about a situation that you've had in DeKalb that mirrors what this CIT officer here in Northbrook experience? Because I think we got to get these stories out.
Right. So we had an OIS, officer involved shooting, just for the community. Officer involved shooting that occurred in 2021. Similar, you know, circumstances. Subject was alone, though, in his residence, and he was barricaded. And unfortunately, the outcome wasn't exactly what we wished for. So, but the steps that were taken were perfect. So we had a officer who did an amazing job trying to de-escalate the situation. When I watch the body worn camera, I'm just amazed how much the conversation that they had. I mean, it took, I mean, he was talking, I mean, nonstop talking for about an hour. And I mean, now, you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, yeah, we're dealing with someone who is not in their best capacity at the time. So they're dealing with mental health issues. But then when you compound it with alcohol or narcotics, I mean, if you're talking about compounding a situation beyond a point where you, I mean, it's hard to talk to someone who is intoxicated and without mental health issues. It's hard to talk to them anyway. So you add that, you know, as another factor, or narcotics added to the into this situation, it becomes almost like you're talking about climbing Mount Everest now when you're trying to talk to someone and get them to respond to you and exit, you know, peacefully. And, you know, so it was extremely hard, but he put so much work into it. I mean, you know, we talked about bringing in, you know, anything and everything, Dave. You bring in family. There's nothing that's not on the board when it comes to trying to bring some of these situations to a peaceful ending. It doesn't matter. Like this gentleman did, you know, switching the firearms over to a family member, whatever it takes, because at the end of the day, as long as the person, as long as there's no loss of life, you won today. We could always go back and fix everything else. One thing we can't repair and we can't fix is when someone loses their life or her life. There's nothing we can't go back to that. So they did everything that they could on this night. Unfortunately, this young man was beyond repair. He was beyond repair. We, you know, our response, you know, tactically was extremely thought out. I mean, we had a crisis intervention officer who, like I said, handled the bulk of this situation. We had people who were supporting him with less than lethal. When I say less than lethal, anything that normally would not lead to the death of an individual. So a taser, we had beanbag deployed, and then we had lethal, of course, with the firearm. So Unfortunately, we went through all the steps that end up leading to, you know, us having to deploy lethal force to stop the gentleman. And it turned out bad, unfortunately, at the end of the day. But the one thing I can say is that the officers did exactly what they were trained to do from the beginning to the end. We took every step to prevent the lethal deployment. But at the end of the day, you know, one thing we didn't talk about, I know we kind of stepped on a little bit, that the health and the protection and the safety of our officers is also paramount. So we have to, as much as we want to save everybody who goes through a crisis, we also have to make sure that our officers make it home to their families as well. So we took the steps that we could. The training was perfect. I mean, the implementation of the training that they learned was perfect. However, it still ended in a situation where a person lost their life. And, you know, and no one ever wants that. No one ever wants that. But we took the steps everywhere in between, Dave, everywhere in between to stop, you know, to stop that situation from turning. However, I mean, like I said, he was beyond repair. He, you know, he came outside with a sword and he attacked the officers. And at that point, what can you do? I mean, right. Truly.
Chief Bird's absolutely right. I'm sorry. I just wanted to echo that. I think for our residents and our listeners, it's really important to know, you know, it is heartbreaking what those officers and what the young man just, you know, obviously his life was ended. And it's not the outcome we want. But at the end of the day, the officers have to be safe as well. And if somebody's undergoing a mental health issue, they still can pull the trigger. They still can kill you or kill people. And, you know, again, it's certainly we would prefer to get them the help they need. There's nobody's walking away from that feeling anything but horrible that a person who's already experiencing a crisis is now, you know, dead. But we also know in our experience that there are people who use the police sometimes as their mechanism to affect their death. And we've had people, I know there are tons of stories where that's occurred, but I also know there are stories where it hasn't occurred, where they've tried that, but they've been unsuccessful. And then they talk about, hey, I wanted you to kill me. Why didn't you kill me? Mm-hmm. Because they couldn't do it themselves. So those are all the complexities that are going on with these mental health calls. And people need to know it isn't, you know, it's not like on TV. It's not really that clear cut. It's rapidly evolving. It's emotional. Officers are reacting to whatever that person's doing. And I think it also something, you know, we're talking a lot about mental health, but in general, you know, we work with a use of force continuum. And I know there's in the police circles, it's always changing. Sometimes we call it continuum. We call it different things. But the basic idea is we start with the lowest level if we can. Lowest level, whenever we're trying to get, if we need to get somebody to do something that's not complying, that could be officer presence. It could be officers standing there a little closer. It could be the number of officers there just to kind of show that, okay, you might not want to start trouble. It could be the tone of your voice, and you can escalate it, you know, move it up the ladder a little bit and say, okay, no, you need to stop doing that. It can go all the way to, I think Chief Lally said, mentioned a hand technique where we just kind of put our hands on a wrist technique, just very low pain, but just compliance. Moving up to physical, you know, grabbing them, holding them, to then moving up to maybe a taser. You know, we've got tasers, which, you know, believe it or not, years ago when tasers were starting, people weren't real fans of them. Again, they look a little bit nasty. I've been tased. It doesn't feel good, I'll tell you that. Our officers get tased to kind of feel what it feels
doesn't
like.
Doesn't look good, doesn't sound good.
So. Yeah, and doesn't look good, doesn't sound good, but it works. But unfortunately, sometimes, as Dave said, you know, we try to be less lethal, but maybe somebody has a heart issue. Maybe, you know, very, very rarely that happens. So early on, people were really fighting against tasers, but tasers have saved lives. I mean, we've been able to tase people without killing them. Then you go up to maybe your firearms where you display it and show it. And that's another, you know, kind of a de-escalation. We don't want you to do it to, unfortunately, if you have to use force. So we go all the way up and down that. We'll move through that. But at the end of the day, again, to Dave's point, our officers have certainly the right. They're out there protecting us. They have a right to go home. And so people, you know, should know, we try to be generally one up or more on people when we're using some sort of de-escalation. So if somebody's, you know, coming at us verbally, we may have our a nightstick or OC spray, the I can't say the word, Olarian Capsium, so, but it's pepper spray. Or, you know, if they come at with a knife, we're not going to fight them with a stick. We're going to have a gun. I mean, we're going to always kind of try to be up one to keep everybody safe, to try to de-escalate and go, okay, maybe my knife against that's not going to work. So it's always about de-escalating, whether it's a criminal element or if it's the mental health piece. But we're always working on that. And I will say too, just lastly, back in the day, because I know Mimi started talking about back in the day, we didn't do a lot with this. I'm going to tell you, you would show up at a scene of a domestic, and you'd see you'd wait to see who your officer, partner, officer was going to be. And you're like, oh my gosh, I hope it's not A, because that person always talks us into a fight because they just didn't have the right skills or the skill set, right? I mean, it's all about your strongest weapon is your gift of gab and your ability to talk people down. And 20, 30 years ago, people just did it without all this training. And you could actually have somebody come on there and you're like, oh boy, we're just heading in a bad direction here. Or somebody that's really good, you're like, okay, this person's going to be good. And then lastly, what we also see now, we actually give recognition to officers who de-escalate. You know, we used to give recognition on great arrests, which we still do. If you took somebody into custody, they fought and you made a really great arrest, but we're actually starting to recognize people. I give them out a lot where they've brought a situation, under control without using any force. Again, it's all predicated on the person that, you know, drives it, but the officers can really do their best. And I think that reinforces the importance of it. We don't want to sacrifice officer safety for it. We certainly don't. The officers have to go home. But if there's any way you can be like everybody around this panel has said, if there is any way you can do it, you're going to do everything you can to de-escalate.
I want to bring up a topic.
Dave,
you wanted to add it?
No, I was really just going to piggyback what Lou said about, it was, you know, we evolved. We have evolved in law enforcement, in this profession, which, and it was a good thing. Let me just say it's a good thing. But like Lou said, one of the things I remember, you know, I came on this job in 1989, so I've been doing it a long time. But back then, Lou is so right. It used to be like, you know, I'm going to tell you, the old guard, they had no time for talking. They had no time for talking. I'm telling you, the old guard, they'd be like, what are you, what are we doing? Like, you know, is he going or if he's not going? I'm telling you, that was the question. Is he going or is he not going? There was no in between. So I think back, and now look, we didn't have the training. Like I said, I mean, we only did what we knew at the time. And what we knew then was, hey, if they commit a crime, we're taking them. You know, that's it. You know, and it wasn't a lot of conversation, I'm telling you. And if you did, if you tried to, even if you're, when you didn't even know what de-escalation was, you just tried to, you know, use common sense. That's basically what we did to try to, you know, bring things to a peaceful ending. You know, guys would just run past you and tackle a guy. You know, it's like, okay, well, I guess that's what we're doing. So, I mean, but now it is, you know, I mean, like Lou said, this is more common for us to do it this way. And it's a good thing. Like I said, I wish I would have known and had the training that I do now back then. I would have handled so many situations so differently. I mean, I really would have. I think back, I mean, it's amazing what you can remember, but there were situations I'm like, you know what? If I'd have had this training back then, that wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't have gotten a fight. At the end of the day, you know, I've gotten hurt in fights that maybe we didn't have to have. You know what I mean? So it's like, at the end of the day, anyone getting hurt or, you know, someone losing their life is a lot. I mean, that's not what you want. So nowadays, like I said, I appreciate my guys every day doing their best with the social workers to make sure that they take people in custody with the least amount of force is required to do that. However, I also tell them, hey, look, when it gets to a point where you have to act, do it. Don't hesitate. Because the one thing that scared me the most was I didn't want them to hesitate to take action when I know that action is required. That's the point that scares me, because like Lou said, at the end of the day, they have to go home to their family. They have children, they have wives, they have husbands, they have partners that they have to go home to. So there's a real thin line, Dave, in there when you're talking about, you know, hey, I want to de-escalate, but I also don't want to hesitate and cause myself to be injured or lose my life as well as a police officer. You know, it's a balancing act. I mean, we're constantly moving the scales, you know, up and down and trying to find that good soft, you know, point and then make that, you know, make the rest that way. So it's tough, it's tough. And you know, and we're, you know, we're looking at it from the, you know, the 100,000 look, you know, view of this whole thing. Well, you're talking about people who are the rank and file, who are on the ground doing this every day. I mean, it's different for them. You know, it truly is. So we just have to be supportive, give them the training, the best training we can ever give them, and then and let them go out there and do their job. So I just had to come up behind Lou on that, because I just remember when I started, man, it was different, man. I'm telling you, it was nothing like it is now. So.
Can I also, Lally, did you want to chime in?
I just wanted to mention real too, because I know the purpose of this podcast too is to kind of let the community know and the public know, you know, like understanding the things that the police departments may be asking for too. So, you know, if asking for more officers and, you know, calls for service today, you know, one call for service in terms of like, especially when it's involving an emotionally distressed person, to, you know, a lot of agencies, their philosophy is different, you know, and for us here, you know, to me, it doesn't matter if it takes 1 hour, 5 hours or a day to have that peaceful resolution or a safer, more positive resolution. So one call might take, you know, 3-4 hours. And so, you know, your other crimes in your city may be going down, your crime rates may be going down, and maybe the community is asking, well, why do you need more officers? Because today, especially with technology, the types of calls of service that we're going to, you know, the need for officers who are well-trained. And that's the other part of having a community that, you know, invests and understands that when, if I'm going in front of the city council asking for, you know, ballistic shields or more money for training to send people to CIT training or sending them to a conference for ICAT, or sending, you know, we have 6 officers here who are trainers in ICAT. And so, having those conversations with the community and, you know, going to council meetings and our council members and letting people know, this is what your department does. And this is why we're asking for the things that we need. And we're asking for funding, you know, and to both of the chief's points, you know, the officers, you know, we have to give them the best training, the best support. So our responsibility is to make sure that we're asking for the money, that we're having those hard conversations, that, you know, when we say, you know, when I went to my city manager and said, I need X amount of dollars to send 4 people to London and Scotland, it's not a vacation, right? So he didn't look at me and say, I said, this is why, because I think we need to do something, and 100% supportive, 100% on board. So we owe it to the officers who do, you know, the community and the officers. Everyone deserves to go home, and one incident that might be a crisis situation should not determine the outcome for someone the rest of their life. So taking that time to slow it down, supporting the officers, giving them the right training, the right tools, learning from, you know, some mistakes that, you know, we can take those learning opportunities. I think it's important that, you know, we have a responsibility too, to make sure that we're the advocates and we're talking to the community and letting them know about. So this is a great way to get some of this information out. And so the community understands, you know, why are they doing this? Or what is this training about? Or how will this affect me? Or, you know, why do they need more officers? Or what are they asking for this funding for? This is why, right? So it's a peaceful and safe resolution for both the officers and the community, which is a win-win for everyone.
For sure. Great point. And I just want to end, you know, we like to keep these under an hour, and we got about another 10 or 12 minutes to go to hit that goal. So I'm going to throw the last scenario around, because what's not talked about is, yeah, you want to take care of the individual, but you also, there's also the cop's mental capacity on the other side that I want each of you to address kind of in like 3 or 4 minute, you know, bits, if you can, so we could try to hit the hour goal. One of the videos was, as Lou mentioned, the individual wanted the cops to shoot him. Okay. And he created a scene. So cops responded, guy was outside of a building. Again, this is with all the video that was there, and he must've been wearing some type of armed forces hat or shirt. and he had 10 officers with their squad cars protecting them with their guns drawn, naturally, right? The guy's outside holding a semi-automatic weapon, threatening to kill himself and other people. So cops were dispatched. And one of the officers was in the same branch of the military as what this individual was wearing, Army, Air Force, Marine, whatever it was, doesn't matter. And that officer was trained in CIT, and that officer broke it down. He wanted the cops to shoot him, Lou, as you just mentioned, right? He wanted to die by being shot, right? He just wanted to end himself, and why he didn't just do it via suicide, I don't know. He just wanted to be there. This cop stepped up, talked to him. Hey, man, what branch? I was there. You know, where'd you train? Broke it down with exactly all four of you have mentioned. But I, you know, nobody talks about the mental part of it. And I know Mimi's husband is an officer of in CPD and all of your training. So I'll start with Mimi. I'll go around the horn. What is it mentally? How does it drain you as an officer and a spouse, right? Knowing that your husband or you or one of your officers when you were a colonel, how does that impact you mentally? And I'll throw it around the horn because I think it's important for the public to know that you guys are humans as well. And your officers are on the front line dealing with all the stress. And yeah, you de-escalated it. But that officer who de-escalated that just, you know, not only should get a plaque, Lou, but had, you know, needs to probably go to counseling him or herself. So start with Mimi and go around the horn.
Yeah, so absolutely, it affects the officer, you know, not just, you know, when it happens, not just the following days, not just months later. It affects them for the rest of their life, to be honest with you. So, you know, and I definitely can relate to that. My husband was involved in a situation, so I feel that, you know, we to this day, you know, it's still talked about between us. Like it's, and I know that, you know, in talking to other, you know, troopers on the job and other officers that have been in similar situations, the same thing. It's something that just doesn't go away. You learn how to cope with it. You learn how to, you know, make sense of it. You learn how to, at times you might break down. I mean, I've talked to many and, you know, been a part of handling that type of, you know, mental capacity, because at the end, nobody wants to do that ever. And it does affect you. And you did say like the spouses, how does it affect the spouses, the family? Absolutely. I mean, it affects your being, which then affects your family. It affects your daily life. Now, you know, you learn how to deal with it. You know, you try to keep yourself busy. You do family things. Like, so it's not something that, it just doesn't ever go away, I guess. Just like we always say, like on the job, you can't unsee things ever. And there's a part of your brain that will always have those images and have those incidents and situations, but you learn how to cope with it over time and you learn how to somehow make sense of it. So yes, I do think that anyone involved, all officers involved in their families, it definitely affects them.
Chief Lally?
Yeah, I think it's important that, you know, when I started in 1996, the department, there wasn't really anything for the mental health support for the officers. So today, you know, we have a peer support program. We have a mental health and wellness coordinator on staff that if there's a critical incident, he's a licensed psychologist, but he's also a pastor. So he can go down and just, you know, these informal conversations that happen in passing and just saying, you know, how are you doing? And not being afraid to ask someone if they're, you know, if they're, they go through something, because each officer is very different. You know, they respond very differently. I too am married to a police officer. He's a sergeant here in the department. Commander of our SWAT team. I've been married to him for, this will be 26 years. And so, you know, it's, people are different, you know, and it, I kind of get to see both sides, you know, being married to someone in the profession, but also being in the profession. And I think it's important that we just do daily, you know, just check-ins with each other and not be afraid to talk about things. Like, you know, when I got hired, it wasn't, you're not talking about stuff. You're going to go handle the call. You're going to, you know, get it done as quickly as possible. And now we really, you know, make a point to have the sergeants and the lieutenants, commanders, chiefs, deputy chiefs talk to people, you know, having resources on staff, making sure that we, you can't be afraid to say, you know what, I just saw something and it's bothering me. And, you know, that's accepted, you know, and it's a culture shift and it takes a little bit of time. But I think as a profession, we are recognizing that. And I think trying to do a lot more than probably all of us ever had. And so we may deal with things a little bit differently and not to be, you know, always to be thinking about that, you know, that everyone responds differently. And creating a culture of, you know, whether it's optimism and resiliency, but also not be afraid to say, you know, this bothered me. Because I think when you tell somebody, and, you know, especially when a lot of times people keep it to themselves, and all it takes is just the one person to be like, hey, are you okay? Because most people, you know, they're like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to go to work. It's going to look like I'm weak. I can't let people know it bothers me. You know, really try to change that mentality where, ask somebody, are you doing okay? You seem a little off today. You know, it's not a bad thing, but do you need anything? Can I help you? And I'm not being intrusive and I'm not trying to, you know, find out everything about you, but hey, you know, I'm here if you need something. So I think the value in the formal programs, you know, the peer programs, the wellness coordinators, all that stuff is good. But I think the second thing, and also is these informal kind of conversations, the day-to-day stuff. Because quite frankly, you know, a lot of times people are so busy with the day-to-day that you really don't stop to think about, like, you know, is this person okay? So you really have to be very mindful about that and say, you know what, I see that officer. Maybe they're not, you know, they went to a really bad call. They're a young officer. You know, I'm going to go check in with them. And I think we sometimes undervalue and underestimate the power of that. And, you know, just saying, are you okay? And do you need anything? And so I think we're trying though. And I think we have to just continue to keep trying.
Chief Bird, you've got social workers as previously mentioned in last week's podcast and this week's podcast for de-escalating on, you know, with the public. What type of support do you have when your officers come back from that call and there's a social worker for the person barricaded and then that person that de-escalated it, what type of support do you have for those officers?
So that we have, are you asking me?
I guess one thing I want to say before I answer that too, Dave, is, you know, I have a lot of experience in this. I was the officer in charge on seven officer involved shootings. So I had, you know, come on scene, it's just, you know, it's chaos, you know. And one of the things, and I always had to sit down and have a conversation with that person who had to use deadly force. And it's traumatic. You know, you can see it in their face. Like, you know, most of these people you know, so you know when the things aren't right. You look at their face, you could tell that they're in a different place. And this was a traumatic situation for them. So with this experience that I've had, what I started doing at ISP, and Mimi was a part of this as well, we would do well-being calls. We would call, we would look at cases, we would look at the log, or we would have captains say, hey, look, we had this situation last night, Colonel, can we put together a call? So we would put together a call like within probably 12 hours of the incident, because we wanted to get an opportunity for that person to either speak or not. So it was an amazing platform, because you had bosses on the call, you had officers who were there that were involved, but maybe not be the point person on it. And then you had the person who actually was the point of this situation. And you know, letting them talk or not, we talked about our experiences, some of the things that we went through throughout our career. Sometimes people just want to listen, and that helps them. But we gave them the opportunity to speak about this situation as soon as possible. We weren't trained specialists. We're not professionals in this, but we were just listening, you know, and sometimes people just want someone to listen to them. So it was good. You know, we did these calls immediately, and then we would always follow up, depending on the situation and how severe, we would do what we call a critical incident debrief. So that's where you bring in some specialists who are specialists in peer support, some people who might have went through the same similar situation in their career, and they can help this officer learn to manage what occurred. Because like Mimi said, you never forget about it. I mean, there are things that'll trigger you, smell, sound. You can drive by a certain place and it'll take you right back to when that situation occurred. It's amazing how your mind works, Dave. And at the end of the day, you learn to manage it. And that's really what, that's the best you can do, is to learn to manage those situations. And, you know, I still to this day, when I drive to my mom's house, she's on 79th and right off the Dan Ryan. I remember going to a call from 4th of July. And I was coming from my mom's house. I stopped in to check on her. We had a baby that got thrown from a vehicle. And every time I, you know, and that and lost his life. I remember walking down that ramp and seeing that baby on the concrete. To this day, every time, I mean, I'm telling you, when I exit there, my mind goes right back to that. It's uncanny how your mind really works and gets triggered by the things that you see when you do this job. So that's why it's imperative, like Chief Valley said, that we give them the support. You know, all the social workers in the building, they come talk to our officers on a daily basis. They have great rapport with them. We have three in the building. They're constantly talking to the officers, you know. And then, like, you know, and I take it upon myself. That is really my job as the chief of police, is to make sure that they are mentally and physically capable of doing their job. And, you know, so I talk to them daily. When I say I have open door policy, it's literally, it's figuratively, they know they can walk in at any time and pull up a chair. What's on your mind? I make my rounds every day. I go to roll call. I look them guys in their face, and I was like, I need to put my eyes on you, because I need to know you're okay. So a lot of the stuff we do, yes, we use the social workers, we use a critical incident debrief, but there's nothing more personable than to have your chief, your command staff, your sergeants look, you know, take care of those rank and file officers. So I think that's where we really make our mark, is to make sure that we're doing that daily.
Amy, you wanted to add something? You held your finger up.
Yeah, really quick. So, you know, Dave talked about those wellness calls that we did. And one of the things that I thought, you know, they really worked, we got a lot of good feedback from the actual officers, was that platform was used to not so much discuss the incident, because that's what we were staying away from, but it was to check on their well-being, to let them know they're not alone, and to thank them for the job they did on the previous incident, and that we were there for them. And that's really what the call was, that you're not alone through this, you're going to experience some things. And then we would always talk about the proper channels on how to vent and how, you know, working out, eating good. We'd always like follow up with, this is what you can do for these next few days to help yourself through this. And then at the end of it, we're always here for you. If you need an ear, here we are, we're here for you. So those were some really good conversations, and just, you know, overall checking on our officers, like we would call them check-in calls, that we would, you know, after an incident or a fatality or what have you. So I just wanted to add that.
Thanks, Mimi. I appreciate your recapping that and adding that to the mix here. Lou, why don't you, you started it, and why don't you end it for us, buddy?
All right. Well, first I have a question. In our contract, do we get overtime? Because we're on overtime.
Oh, okay.
So is that in the contract?
You want me to pay for everybody's overtime here? Is that?
Yeah, I appreciate that. We get it. That is absolutely. All right. Definitely good conversation today. And I think we really started to delve into a topic that we for sure will have in another episode. And that's officer wellness. I mean, that is a really important part. So I'll just end it on these two things. Number one, I think everybody said it, but it's true. And people have to realize that this job, law enforcement, who you are when you start at 21, 22, 23, or whenever you start, it's not who you are when you leave. It is cumulative. These events that you go on, they take a lot out of you, even if they're resolved successfully. Everyone you go on, extremely stressful. You don't just walk away and go on to the next call. If that person's taken to the hospital and it's successful, you know, for a mental health check or however it is resolved successfully, it still is incredibly tense. It takes a toll on you over your career. And I just want, you know, again, always trying to tie it back for our public. I want you to know the increased risk that our officers are taking by by really embracing this de-escalation philosophy. They're putting themselves at increased risk. You know, Dave talked about before, it was, hey, the person's there, we got to take them to custody. Let's not give them a chance to think, to do anything, to pull a gun. We're on them. And so all this time we now give people, and a lot of times it's mental health calls, but you don't know, you're still giving people time trying to de-escalate. And that's also for people with nefarious reasons or nefarious plans. You're giving them time to think of a way to escape, to hurt you, to kill you. So there's a balance there. And I just want our community members to know that our officers are putting themselves at greater risk by trying and by putting the public first, by putting people first to make sure they're safe. They are increasing their risk. There's no doubt about it. So we just can't take that for granted. Our officers that are spending the time putting themselves in different positions, coming out from cover to talk to people because they think that maybe that'll help, that's putting them at risk. And so we really need to respect and honor that. It's important. So I just wanted to end on that. Great conversation, everybody.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Behind the Badge, Illinois. If you look again, unsolicited plug here, since I'm funding this, if you're looking to purchase a new home or refinance your existing home, call Team Hochberg, 855-56-DAVID, or go to 56David.com. And also, if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, give me a call. We'll talk to you about sponsorship opportunities. Thank you, Chief Lally. Outstanding job. You are no longer a rookie.
Thank you.
We will have a ceremony for you later in somewhere at Lou's expense. Chief Byrne, as always, Mimi, thank you. And Chief Jogman, you look great in your whites today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And stay tuned for another episode of Behind the Badge, Illinois.